This morning you had read in your hearing James chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. The whole concept of counting it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations, knowing that the trying of your faith works patience. And while we're not necessarily getting into the counting it all joy or what that means, and we're not necessarily trying to define diverse temptations because that's pretty much self-explanatory, we are talking about the topic of patience and allowing patience to have its perfect work. And what is that perfect work? Well, the verse actually tells you right after that. Patience may have her perfect work that you may be complete, entire, mature, lacking nothing. Lacking nothing. And of course, the verses beyond tell you that if you do lack something, well, then ask of God, and he'll give it, as he gives to all men liberally. But the concept we're going for this morning is really patience. And when you think about patience, it is not simply a lesser Christian problem. This isn't something that just affects the newly saved or people that seem to have temperamental issues that can't grow out of it, while the rest of us are beyond that. It's not the case at all. You'll remember folks throughout history that have been a little short with God in the category of patience. In fact, you'll remember Job, who started very well, very well. In fact, the scriptures commend him through his first few chapters of how he dealt with a lot of problem, trouble, and turmoil. But you've got 42 chapters. So then the next 38-ish, 39, Job gets just a little short on the side of patience. Just a little. I say that tongue in cheek. You remember David? David. While David had a phenomenal amount of virtues, some that we wish we could really emulate. I mean, if you could see God as real as David saw him at very pivotal times in life, in physical circumstances against real adversaries, and have the theology that he had, wow! I mean, we'd really feel like we've arrived. But David also had what we also might call human shortfalls, one of which centered on patience. You might remember Peter just a bit. And if I talk about Peter and the lack of patience, you go, oh yeah, I got that one. You didn't have to say that. That was the first thing that came to my mind, Peter. Yes, open mouth, insert foot, all the time. Until he matured, and we see some fantastic writing from him. Fantastic, under inspiration of the Spirit. Maybe you remember Elijah a bit. Little bit of impatience there. Maybe you remember Jonah. Yes, another one that probably came immediately to mind when it was impatience with God. What I'm trying to get at this morning is these are not lowly people. These are not newly saved folks that just had an issue. These are some great saints. And they had problems with impatience. So when we talk about the concept of letting patience have its perfect work, or that the trying of your faith works patience, this is not something isolated to a few. This affects everyone, from the greatest saint you can imagine down to the one who's just saved moments ago. Patience. Impatience, then, is an eagerness to do something now. You must do it now. It is an unwillingness to wait. I'm not waiting on anything. It is a restlessness or shortness of temper, especially when you are irritated, delayed, and you don't feel there's a reason to be delayed. If you ever want to be delayed where there's no reason to be delayed, be on that Northway between 7:30 and 8 a.m. No reason for that, but there it is every day. Opposition, intolerance of anything that thwarts or hinders your plans. You've got this great plan laid out and you're running to it and something smacks it over and impatience hits. It's kind of can also be a tendency toward being irritable. But with descriptions like that, restlessness, eagerness, unwillingness, irritableness, shortness of temper, intolerance, this is more than likely not the character quality that you and I would really like to be known for. Oh, him? Yeah, if you've ever seen an impatient person, it's his picture there in the dictionary next to that word. Probably not. But it is one character quality that we probably all display, maybe a little too often. I'll give you an example of that. So you see this morning announcements that flash, and probably for 3 weeks now I've had these things ready to go, but I have encountered a technical difficulty that I did not plan on. And I was foolish not to plan on it because I know what we have to work with. So it's my fault. And yet I'm getting impatient. And I'm like, ugh, are you kidding? Because I thought I took care of that. Oh, nope, you didn't. I thought I planned for this. Oh, nope, you didn't. And I'm growing impatient with myself. And I can't believe that I didn't count for all that stuff. And all of a sudden I'm walking around feeling aggravated in my temperament. And that's probably showing to people. And it should be the last thing showing to people because it's not their fault. It's mine. Impatience. But in light of James 1:2-4, it has been said that impatience is the mother of all mistakes and the father of all irritation. Or impatience, in short, encapsulates everything which denies a good ripening. While a certain amount of impatience may be useful to stimulate us and motivate us to action, a lack of patience is one of the major causes of the difficulties and unhappinesses the world faces today. And finally, it is not the adversity that kills us, it is the impatience with which we bear the adversity. Impatience. And so this is an age-old problem with sometimes what we often think is no easy solution. And it begs the question, what do we do with impatience? How do we deal with our unwillingness to wait, our natural fail, our short-temperedness, our irritableness, our intolerance of stops, those unexpected holdups and delays? How do we effectively combat our own impatience? How do we bear through that adversity a lot better? And it becomes especially important when our impatience is aimed at God. When we grow hasty in spirit, he that is slow to wrath is of great understanding, but he that is hasty of spirit exalts folly, Proverbs 14:29. When we grow hasty in our words, see thou a man that is hasty in his words? There is more hope of a fool than of him. When we grow hasty in our wants, the thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but everyone that is hasty only to want. All because we grow increasingly impatient with God's plan. Are you sure, God, this is right? We grow impatient with God's purposes. Are you sure, God, that's the best? We grow impatient with God's prudence. Are you sure, God, you even know what's going on? When we grow impatient with God's providence. Is this really supposed to be happening to me, or was this really meant for someone else and I just got caught up as an innocent bystander? In other words, we grow increasingly short with the unexpected changes, holdups, and delays in our lives, and we point that back to God as somehow it's his problem. And all that does is compound things. So let me ask you this morning, have you ever grown impatient? Have you ever grown impatient with God? What did you do with your unwillingness to wait on his timing? What did you do with your unwillingness to kind of allow him to operate the way he's going to operate in his plan and according to his purpose? What did you do with your routine irritableness over your short stop? And how did you overcome your intolerance for all the obstacles that seem to have been getting put in your way to your plan? Have you ever become impatient? No doubt you responded one of two ways. You either responded in the flesh, where you questioned it all, or you responded in the spirit, where you acknowledged and accepted it. These are two words pastors pretty much coined here, correct? Acknowledge and accept. We're actually in Psalm 13 this morning, and I'm going to give you a chance to get there. We're not in James 1, we're in Psalm 13. It's a six-verse psalm. And in these six verses, I'm going to ask you if you notice any hint of impatience. You can tell me whether you notice or not. And then I'm going to ask you if you notice any hint of a successful solution to that impatience. So Psalm 13, six short verses. And the psalmist writes, "How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord? Forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and hear me, O Lord my God. Lighten mine eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death, lest mine enemy say, I have prevailed against him, and lest those that trouble me rejoice when I'm moved. But I have trusted in thy mercy. And in fact, my heart shall rejoice in thy salvation, and I will sing unto the Lord, because he hath dealt bountifully with me." Any hint of impatience? Any at all? You say, well, there are only six verses here, and if I had to guess, maybe the first four. That would be a little hint that I'm growing impatient with something. How long? How long? How long? How long? How many times does he mention that? Four. Is that a theme? Yes. Yes. And I thank you, Pastor Craig. I love that. How long will you forget me? And what is the answer? Forever. So we not only have impatience, we got a little sarcasm going on here. And who's this from? Yes, the psalm is written by David. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm trying to get home one point this morning. Impatience is not a little thing. And I dare say, more than not, all of us have probably felt a lot like David at certain times in our lives. And as a matter of fact, if it's not just us individually, with our certain set of circumstances, we probably look around nationally and still ask all of these same questions. How long will you forget the righteous in this country that have to yield to those people? Forever? How long are you going to hide your face from us over here and lead us down this path of sheer ungodliness? Is there any hope? How long do we have to take counsel in our own heart and console ourselves because you're not? And how long are our enemies going to be exalted? How long do they get to keep these positions of power and keep making these absolutely ridiculous, grating rules? When do any of them face justice? Is there such a thing anymore? The wrong movement is touting this, you know. Consider and hear. Lighten our eyes, lest we sleep the sleep of death, and lest our enemies say, we've prevailed, and we're moved. Removed is the point. Done. Gone. Pushed to the side. You could look at that nationally and have those exact same questions if you didn't have them individually. And I dare say if you have any diet of news in this day and age, you're probably leaving that channel feeling that exact way every single time you see it. And so the natural response of our flesh is indeed impatience. And there is the psalmist, and he is demanding straight answers. You answer me now. How long? And that takes many different shapes and forms. But when these kinds of demands are made of God, they take on a whole new meaning, one in which we, the creature, reserve the right to demand of God, the creator, that he answers to us. Why are you leading this way? Why is this the best? Tell me now. And that's dangerous ground. You say, boy, it's like an angry preaching here. No, I'm just trying to get across the feeling we often feel when we speak this way. This is dangerous ground, and this is ground we really need to tread carefully. And that's because we don't want simple expressions of grievances to become all-out accusations where we start to form opinions against God that are contrary to his very nature and start going down that path, which changes the glory of God into that which is not glory, and where the creature exalted above the creator, and there we all are, Romans chapter 1. Where we think we are justified to make ourselves judges over God's leadership and his behavior. Improper. Where we reserve the right to tell God what's right and what's wrong. Where we reserve the right to tell God what's best and what's worse. Where we reserve the right to tell God what's wise and what's unwise. Where we reserve the right to tell God how things ought to be and how things ought not to be. Get with the plan, as it were. But David wouldn't be the first person to start demanding of God in this way. I mean, as long as you and I on this earth, he will not be the last one either. In fact, Job says, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me, when his candle shined upon my head, and when by his light I walked through the darkness. And I was in the days of my youth, when the counsel of God was over my house, when the Almighty was yet with me. For now my soul is poured out upon me, and the days of affliction have taken hold. He hath cast me into the mire. I'm become like dust and ashes. I cry, and he does not hear me. I stand up, he does not regard me. He has become cruel, and with his strong hand he opposes me. He lifts me up to the wind, and he causes me to ride upon it to the dissolving of my substance." And on at least three separate occasions, that growing frustration comes through, and Job says, "Surely I would speak to the Almighty. I would desire to reason with God." That's saying I would desire an answer of him. "I would ask him, wherefore hidest thou thy face and holdest me for thine enemy?" Job 23, "Today my complaint is bitter. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would order my cause before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would like to know the words which he would answer me and be able to consider what he would say." This is Job talking about God. Job 31:35, "Oh, that the Almighty would answer me." And here, David is asking, how long? And in modern times, we might turn that into simply saying, "How long are you going to ignore me, O Lord? When will you start caring about me again? How long are you going to hide yourself away and not show your face anymore? Am I shelved? How long am I going to have to go it alone and struggle on my own where you are not there to hold my hand? You're not there to guide me. You're not there to step-by-step counsel me. There's nothing. How long are those that care less about me going to rule, some of which are my active enemies seeking my hurt? How long?" But it's not just not here that that question rings out. There are seven other times in the book of Psalms where the psalmist will ask, "Lord, how long will thou look on and not rescue my soul from destruction? How long shall the adversary reproach and the enemy blaspheme thy name? How long wilt thou be angry? How long wilt thou be angry against the prayer of thy people? How long wilt thou hide thyself? How long till thou return, O Lord? How long shall the wicked triumph? How long shall they utterly speak hard things and all the workers of iniquity boast themselves?" Does any of that sound familiar? If it does, you're obviously in good company, because that's what the psalmist writes. Because just like David and just like Job, you and I ask these same things. By principle, doesn't God say, when it comes to the matter of forgetting, "For the Lord thy God is a merciful God. He will not forsake thee, neither destroy thee, nor forget the covenant of thy fathers which he sware unto them." And concerning the matter of when God will or will not show his face, does he not say, "For the Lord will bless thee and keep thee. The Lord will make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. He will lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace." Numbers chapter 6. Concerning the matter of comfort, does not the Lord say, "For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort so that joy and gladness are found therein, both thanksgiving and the voice of melody," Isaiah 51. Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prisons to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all that mourn. Very words that Christ used to announce himself in the temple, or in one of the synagogues. And concerning the matter of our peace and safety, the Lord says, for I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. Then shall ye call upon me. You shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you. You shall seek me, and you shall find me, when you search for me with all your heart, and I will be found of you, saith the Lord. And so based on those principles, don't we then, by practice, aspire to make the following goals a reality? In other words, living a life that reflects an ever-present reality that you will, in fact, behold God's face in righteousness, that you will be satisfied when you awake with his likeness, that your heart will reflect a proper singular state of being that says, seek my face. So my heart said back to thee, thy face, Lord, will I seek. So that part of your ever-present reality is taming your desires and reflecting the proper singular passion. One thing have I desired of the Lord that I will constantly seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and reflect upon his temple. So we make these goals. And what happens? While striving to have our practice line up with God's principles, in order to enjoy the rewards of all his promise, we find there are certain things that his promises don't seem to line up with, or that his practices don't seem to be as rewarding as those principles led on. And that causes no small confusion. So what am I getting at this morning? Impatience is the driver of all wrong mentality when it comes to God. Impatience is the driver of all wrong activity and attitude when it comes to God. And when you find yourself complaining in impatience about any one thing, what is it you're complaining about? God's purpose? God's plan? God's providence? So I'm here to tell you, there are probably 90% of folks in this room that are very unhappy about a specific situation in their life, whatever that is, very much so. And they wake up morning by morning, grieve over whatever. And oftentimes, if they don't check that with any measure of thanksgiving or with any measure of acknowledgement and acceptance of God's will, impatience sets in. And so that grieving becomes a heartache that turns into anger that runs to bitterness. And now we need Pastor Beckwith's book to get us back out of that thing and to show us what real life is like in joy, because we've lost it all. And so that mindset is confusing. Things don't seem to be working the way we think they should or expect them to be, and there go the start of our impatience. And when we start aiming that at God and we start becoming accusatory to him and we miss everything about his purpose and plan, that's the wrong response. What we fail to realize and really have to take consideration is that the question of how long, guess what? It goes two ways. While we reserve the right to raise our fist to God and demand answers, how long, how long, how long, how long? Guess what? God reserves the right to fix his eyes on men and start demanding answers from them as well. And in fact, he starts to do that to Job himself. Where were you when I created the heavens and the earth? Where were you when I needed counsel for anything? Were you my counselor? No. And he does that to other people throughout scriptures as well. God will say, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me in Exodus chapter 10, verse 3? How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws, Exodus 16, 28? How long will this people provoke me? How long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I've showed them? And how long shall I have to bear with an evil congregation which murmurs against me? And that's on the daily. Exodus, or Numbers 14, excuse me. How long will you halt between two opinions? 1 Kings 18:21. How long will you turn my glory into shame? And how long will you love vanity and seek after lies? The word is leasing. Psalm 4:2. How long will you judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? How long, you simple ones, will you love your simplicity and you scorners delight in your scorning? And how long will you fools hate knowledge? Proverbs 1:22. How long will you sleep, O sluggard? When will you arise out of your sleep? Proverbs 6:9. How long shall thy vain thoughts lodge within thee? Jeremiah 4:14. How long wilt thou turn away, O thou backsliding daughter? Jeremiah 31:22. How long will it be ere you attain innocency from your guilt? Hosea 8:5. O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I suffer you? Jesus says in Matthew 17. That's a little convicting. Just this much. And often when we aim that question at God, it is because we are not humble. And often when we fail to acknowledge and accept and live within the confines of what God sets out for us, it is because we are not accepting his commandments and refuse him at every turn. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that way. It's not what I like. It's not my gift. It's not my talent. Do I look like I'm strengthened there? Mm-mm. We often find this with teens in teen camp, right? So I got the opportunity to work at the Wilds a couple years and another camp in Wisconsin a couple years. And what I find amazing about teens is they have this uncanny ability to hate God's will. Because for them, it means a mud hut with big bugs and snakes in the middle of who knows where. Talk about a third world country, Africa. Well, who knows where? And who wants that? Julia Jensen is getting married here in another month or so. And she talks about people who often find their Africa. And what she's using is the Africa is the detested place nobody wants to serve. And so when people come across God's will and dislike it, that's their Africa, if you will. And oftentimes in teen camp, I find that funny that kids have a lot of Africas. And very few Floridas. In fact, I was that way myself. I can remember a time in Bible college, going to Bible college for one reason. I was going to college just to get a degree because then I could go back to the sheriff's office and be promoted without a degree. You don't get promotion. You just stay low life forever. You might make it private and you know whatever, but you're not going to make sergeant and above. Definitely not going to make an officer, lieutenant, or captain. So I had my goal. I had my plan. And my mom's like, hey, if you go to a Christian college, I'll pay for it instead of going to the local one down here. Okay, great, fine. And then God's calling me to the ministry and I'm like, no. Why? Why on earth would I want to do that? Do you know what those people have to do all the time? They have to study. Ugh. You have to understand, in high school, I lived on the beach, basically, until my dad kicked me out of the house because, you know, I was bringing home D. And I barely am graduating every grade, right? He's like, listen, I don't have time to take care of you. I'm obviously working all the time, doing some other thing. You're just running off on your own, so you got to get out, you know? It was that bad. So me and study? No, oh, come on. And then study something like Greek and Hebrew? Who does that? That's why there's that saying, it's all Greek to me. I don't know any of that. I don't want to know any of that. Are you kidding? So I'm going to sit in an office all day and read old archaic books about old archaic stuff? Nope, not doing that. I could have fun over here. I mean, over here, I get to chase people down the road and go high speeds. Over here, I get to be where the action is. Over here, I get to do fun stuff, and I get to catch people doing stupid things where they thought they would never be caught, and I can try to convince them that they really need a new career because they're just not good at this one. And I can do all kinds of cool things, and I got this car, and it's got all this, it's equipped. Oh, don't forget about the whole gun thing. Everybody loves the gun thing. Well, maybe not nowadays, they don't, but they used to. Real power trip. You're given a 21, 22-year-old a gun, and you don't expect them to be on a power trip. Point is, a lot of fun. Old archaic books. Awesome times. Study Greek. Which would you choose? So teens have a lot of Africas, a lot of things to overcome with God's will, just not seeing it. Mm-mm, it is not me. No, sir. And what ends up happening is that is a refusal to God. You can turn that into a provoking to God where you resist and you resist and you resist God's will. You can turn that into something where you become a murmurer against God because his will keeps coming back and convicting your heart, and you come to that point where you don't want to hear it. Knock off convicting me about that. And then you set yourself up for judgment. And then you get mad that you get judged. Well, that's dumb. You're the one that did it. But he, oh yeah, it's his fault. And this happens all the time. And then you have two opinions that you halt between. Do I really want to serve God, or do I really want to do this other thing? And then you start to judge unjustly. And then you become like the simple one who becomes the scorner, who becomes the fool that finally hates knowledge. And then you are spiritually asleep. When will you awake, O sluggard? And how long shall your vain thoughts lodge within you? And how long will you keep turning away, O backsliding daughter? Do you see the progression there? It starts easily enough, but it ends way over here. And so God's how long coming the other direction can be quite convicting. So on one hand, you and I are confused and frustrated and impatient and angry and inappropriately demanding God's answers for his apparent lack of judgment and his apparent lack of understanding and fairness and justice in our lives, to insinuate that God would do anything less than our best. And on the other hand, you have a long-suffering, compassionate, and merciful God who demands answers from us, hoping to reason with us. Come now, let us reason together, saith the Lord. I'm not here to smack you around. I'm just trying to reason with you. Will you not understand? And both are asking the exact same question, but two different perspectives. How long? And so when it comes to that question, how long, what's your best guess at man's answer to God at how long he's going to be the way he is? I mean, if you really had to give God an answer of how long you refuse to humble yourself, how long are you going to give him? I guess by next month, Lord, I'll be good. If you had to answer God and how long you refuse to keep his commandments and his laws, how long would you say you're going to, you know, well, here's my answer, God. If you had to give him an answer of how long, how much longer you're going to provoke him, how much longer are you going to do that? How much longer he has to bear up against your murmuring and complaining? You know, when are you going to stop that? What's your answer? And what do you think God's answer is to us when we turn around and go, how long are you going to forget me forever? What do you think about those things? The Apostle Paul, addressing the same question, that questioning of God, writes in Romans, what shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Is there? God forbid. For he saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. Thou wilt say then unto me, well, why doth he yes find fault? For who hath resisted his will? Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter the power over the clay? And if that's not your favorite response when demanding answers from God, we could look at other responses, like the response gave to Job, which I talked about a little bit. Who is he that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. And then God goes on for two chapters demanding answers to his questions. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare it if thou hast understanding. Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days and caused the dawn to know when to rise? Have the gates of death been opened unto thee, or hast thou seen the doors to the place of the dead? Declare it if thou knowest it all. Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven? Or canst thou set the domain thereof in the earth? Who hath put wisdom in the inward parts? Who hath given understanding to the heart? And God finally ends with the following. Shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproveth God, let him answer. Now, if that's also not your favorite response when demanding answers from God, I suppose we could go elsewhere. Anybody like a third round of answers? So exactly how do you expect to be answered when you start making demands, and how do we overcome the whole concept of impatience with God? And the key is really found in the last two verses, because it almost seems like a night and day difference. Here you have in chapter 13, four distinct verses of how long, how long, how long, how long. Consider and hear, light in mine eyes, lest I sleep at death. Mine enemies are going to prevail against me, and they're going to rejoice when I am removed. And it's almost as if out of nowhere, verse 5 comes, and it doesn't seem to link up to the other first four. But I have trusted in thy what? Mercy. It is by God's mercy that we are not consumed. Because what is God's mercy? The literal definition is compassion and pity. Yesterday, the church work day, apparently there was some round of bunnies that got disturbed, a nest over by the church office. And so one little baby bunny decided his little habitat would be right under the lip of the door to the church offices, that one door that goes right up. So there's that metal lip that hangs out, and there's a little drop, and then there's the asphalt. And right there in the door is where he snuggled in. There he was. And when my kids saw that, especially my daughters, what do you think they had on that poor little bunny? Oh, give me that stupid thing, kick it! No, they didn't do that. Oh, look at the little bunny. Daddy, can we rescue it and take it to our backyard where we know there are bunnies back by the pond? And can we put it over there? And maybe some other bunny will find that bunny and they'll adopt it. And some other mother bunny will love that bunny. And the bunny will grow up. And then we'll see the bunny. All this kind of stuff, right? Compassion, 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 compassion. Nothing but compassion. I don't feel that way about cats. I see a cat, I'm going to kick it. But they feel that way about that bunny, and they were showing such compassion for that poor plight of that poor little thing. It was helpless. It was defenseless. It was a baby. It could literally do almost nothing for itself. And there go you and I. There we are. Sheep. Sheep are dumb. I'm sorry to have to tell you, but sheep are stupid. You think there's a dumber animal on this earth, I don't know what it would be. Than a sheep, who will walk willingly and happily right to its slaughter. Here we go. Dumb thing. And yet that's what we are. Oh, we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to their own way. And yet it is in God's compassion and God's mercy that he answers us. And so the psalmist is putting himself right in that thing. I have chosen rather, instead of sitting here where I'm going to get all bitter and bent out of shape because God seems to be forgetting me forever, and I'm stuck in this whatever it is that is less than desirable, that I cannot stand, can't believe God even put me here, I hate every second and loathe it, and man, when I get a certain age, I'm out of this job. You know, whatever it is, I've trusted in God's mercy. I've put all that aside for the sake of God's mercy. So my heart shall rejoice in God's salvation, and I will sing unto the Lord because he hath dealt bountifully with me. Bountifully? Have you not read those first few verses? He's forgotten forever. God's hidden his face. He has to console himself. God's not there consoling his heart. It's just him. His enemy is exalted. He's going to sleep the sleep of death. And God's dealt bountifully? Where's he getting that? Because he knows his God. And he knows his God above his circumstances. And he knows his God and his God's character and his God's attributes and all of those things that make God truly who he is, well above what he feels he's experiencing on this earth. And he sees it as real. And he knows it to be genuine. And it is that mercy that he's holding on to, and he understands God's compassion is in fact going to kick in. But God's got a purpose in the here and now. It seems like forever. It seems like he's self-consoling, but truly he's not. And the very way you know he's not is because his heart keeps coming back to God's mercy. Who's doing that? It's not him. It's the Spirit. And so, ladies and gentlemen, take heart. How do you and I deal with impatience with God? And it is simply this: when we put our trust back in his mercy, and when we start understanding that he is dealing very, very bountifully with us, there is a plan. Do you understand it? No. There is a purpose. Do you always see it? No. There is providential leading and guiding. He is solely on that throne. He's not some old guy who sat on a rocker and forgot everything. He's right there active. Can you tell that all the time? No. But your heart trusts. And the Spirit brings you back, and the Spirit brings you back, and the Spirit brings you back, and you rest in God's mercy, and you start to not look at, Pastor would say, this Wednesday night even, looking not on the things which you don't have, but on the things which you do, and you find out just actually how bountifully God has dealt with you. And what does that well up in him? I have trusted in thy mercy, my heart shall rejoice, and I will sing. I saw a YouTube short. It's kind of one of these reels that people create. And the YouTube short was basically, you know, the Bible hack to anxiety and worry. And it was like this 30-second thing, and this guy's going on about, here's the Bible's hack to your anxiety. Well, the Bible doesn't have a hack. It's an answer. But the point is, he was saying, you know, in Philippians it talks about your supplication with thanksgiving and joy. And what we lack in this country is any type of thanksgiving and joy. In fact, people sell their thanksgiving and joy for such things as their anger and frustration. They're giving it away willingly. And they will choose to put their heart on things and meditate their heart on things which have nothing to do with where we should be parking our minds, which causes that thanksgiving and that joy, which causes us to want to sing unto the Lord because of his bountiful dealings. Otherwise, how do you find the Apostle Paul and Silas in prison at midnight or some other time late in the evening starting to sing, and then God works on behalf of that kind of heart of gratitude where they're in the midst of, they think they're going to die. But that is not a reason not to be thankful, and that is not a reason not to praise God. And so there they go. And people are over here praying. And it happens. And then you know the end of that story. Now, we don't see that all the time, where the prison doors just break open by angels who come down and here go everybody. But the idea is, there is no point in life, even in all of this complaint, where we should cease ever from trusting in God's mercy, or we should cease ever from rejoicing in God, or we should cease ever from singing to God praise because of his bountiful dealing. There is no time ever that should stop. Because that's when we stop glorifying God as God and we stop being thankful and we go right down the road, the wrong one. So when it comes to our impatience, there's a lot more could be said. But the point is this: do you trust in God's mercy? Does your heart rejoice in his working in your life and his dealing with you, even if you presently don't actually like the circumstance? Do you sing to the Lord because he's dealt bountifully or because he's impoverished you? If you think about that, there's an old poem that says, one by one he took them from me, all the things I love the most, till I was empty-handed, every glittering toy was lost. I walked earth's highways grieving in my rags and poverty until I heard a voice inviting, lift those hands to me. And one by one, he gave back, and he filled those hands ever with a store. And then finally I comprehended with my stupid mind and dull, God cannot fill hands already full. And what ends up happening is when you and I are put in a place where we must just trust in his mercy and we must just be grateful and thankful, he is trying to take out of our hands, rend from us all those things we have substituted for joy and all those things we have substituted for our happiness and all those things we have substituted for what was going to comprise our plan. And he's changed it all up. And he's put us back on the path of himself and his bounty. Trusting in his mercy. So impatience. How do we deal with it? How will we deal with it going forward? Let's pray and we'll be dismissed. Father, thank you this morning for this opportunity to look into your word. And we would pray, Lord God, that you would help us in every way, to throw ourselves back upon your compassion and mercy and trust in your character. And then, Lord, to go beyond that and praise you for your work in our lives and to rejoice in that patience having its perfect work, that we may be ensure, entire, complete, lacking nothing. That you may bring us to the fullness of the measure of the stature of Christ even. And this we would pray earnestly in Jesus' name. Amen.